Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-popular and ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you want to scroll around to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find a link to the chat room. That's a great place to roll in with the usual suspects. And if you have some observations or some questions that you would like for us to ask our guests, that's a good place to put them up there. We'll be glad to steal your great ideas and fold it into the show as we go forward. Also, if you have to jump out halfway through the show to take care of your business, we have the ability, a couple of different ways that you can make sure and catch all you may have missed. You can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can go the easy way and go over to iTunes, search for Midrats, and go ahead and subscribe to the podcast and listen at your leisure. Occasionally, for those that are with us live at the 60-minute mark, the mic will go dead, but the recorder keeps recording, and we may want to give our guests more time to finish answering the questions, or there's one or two other questions we just want to ask before we release them, but that's a place you can go ahead and catch the after show as well. But hey, let's go ahead and get on with the show. We, for those that follow the news, as I know all of you do, we're once again having a national discussion with the promise of a limited and hopefully short period conflict with a rather ill-defined strategic and operational design that a lot of people are still figuring out. Of course, talking about our response to the Islamic State over in Syria and Iraq. But we're also at the centenary of the beginning of the First World War. And there are some things, not just back in the last 100 years, but even further, that can help inform some of the decisions and some of the puzzles that we look at today. History shows that our military and political leaders have a habit of either over or underappreciating how technology may have changed things, how the doctrine they use or are planning to use may not quite be what they think. And also, there's an imperfect correlation, even when you're trying to reference the past, between what may have happened and how it actually applies to today. And from the national psyche, how it can affect nations, to the warfighter who find themselves, instead of being home for Christmas, having to double the size of their forces and not having the material are the people to do what needs to be done to avoid national collapse. And that's what happens when the short and splendid turns into the long slog. And our guest today is just the right guy to help us talk about this issue and a few more. And we're going to use as a touching off point an article he put in the National Interest recently titled "The Most Terrifying Lessons of World War I, War Is Not Always Short and Sharp." He is Chris Doherty. He is a research fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, CSBA, some of y'all may know. He also has a background as an infantryman with the Army that we won't hold against him. Chris, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Hey, I mentioned in the introductory, and I always like to give an opportunity for our listeners kind of to get a reference point on our guests. I know a lot of them have probably seen and some of the things that they've read or watched CSBA, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, where you are right now. If you could, take a minute and tell us, what is the CSBA, what do they invest a lot of their time in, and what is your role there?
CSBA is a small, not-for-profit, nonpartisan research institution, known in the D.C. parlance as a think tank. And we do a lot of long-range strategic and operational assessments, but we also mix that with a pretty strong budgetary assessment side led by my colleague Todd Harrison, who's kind of known in D.C. circles as a defense budget guru, and he really is quite good on those issues. But we like to look anywhere from 10 to even 30, 35 years out, depending on the kind of assessment we're doing, and take a long-range net assessment view. We've been pretty heavily influenced by the Office of Net Assessment led by Andrew Marshall in the Pentagon, so we've got a lot of that flavor to the way we look at the world. And we like to put things out a little bit further because we like to get out of the near-term programmatics of issues and really delve deeply into the strategy and the operational side and the long-term competitions that drive military strategy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your piece of national interest, which raised some good points about the success in some of our recent wars, just like the successes in people fighting before World War I, led them to believe that war could be short and sharp. Could you kind of go through that analysis a little bit?
Absolutely. As part of my work for CSBA, we do a lot of war gaming, and we do a lot of these kind of operational level assessments. And one of the things I've noticed is that there's a real belief that particularly precision-guided munitions have fundamentally altered the balance of military power in many ways. And, you know, you've kind of heard, obviously, about the Revolution of Military Affairs and with all the pejorative stuff that kind of comes along with that. But I do think there is something to the impact that precision-guided weapons have had on the battlefield. And I think that what we haven't seen yet is really two major powers with precision-guided weapons and all the kind of modern warfare accoutrement that come up along with that go to war with one another. And so what you see is kind of an analogous situation to what you saw in the late 19th century up until, you know, the early 20th century prior to World War I, in which you see the advent of things like, you know, what we would know as a modern machine gun and recoil-compensated artillery with aircraft to spot for it and wireless command and control networks and all the kind of things that we saw fighting against each other in World War I, but we'd never really seen applied against each other beforehand by two capable, competent adversaries. Whereas before, you know, the First World War, there were all these wars in which European powers went to war against colonial opponents and used things like the Maxim gun to beat up on them. I don't really think we saw prior to World War I two sides use it against each other. And so I think if you look at our current era, what you see is a lot of use of precision-guided munition where the United States is using against an adversary that simply doesn't have the ability to fight back. And so it's given us kind of an odd sense of what these weapons will interact or how they'll interact on the battlefield when both sides are using it. And so my piece really tries to delve into, we're not really certain of how that will go. And so the present belief that wars, conventional wars between two major powers, could actually be short and sharp, maybe very, very misguided, if that's not the case.
When in doubt, I always like to go back to the fundamentals, and I know in some areas it's so fundamental that it's fallen out of favor, but I've always been a fan of short acronyms, especially those that define well challenges, the old DINE, the diplomatic, informational, military, and economic, you know, those different levers of national power. And you know, you just got through talking about the military mindset that we can see having a repeating problem. But in your article, you have a great quote, I think, that outlines some of the other areas of national power that we can see a conceit in play. The economic part, economists and businessmen before the First World War, and you have right here, you saw both, and this is, I'm going to quote, short quote from your article, quote, between 1914 and 2014, there is a failure to prepare for the possibility of protracted conflict based upon the flawed belief that conventional war between great powers would be brief and decisive. If you could please talk about that conceit that we saw before the First World War and how you can see a similar concept, thought, and dismissal of a possibility today.
So, I mean, I'm sure most of listeners will be familiar with the short war illusion prior to the First World War, but you know, really briefly to touch on it, it was a belief among most of the great powers prior to World War I that they could conduct offensive operations and kind of be the aggressor in a war, and that they would be able to take and seize territory that maybe they believed it was theirs. So in the case of France, it would be Alsace-Lorraine. In the case of Germany, it was the ability to establish themselves as an imperial power and the hegemon of Europe, and you know, all these various things. You know, the Italians wanted to take back territory from the Austrians. The Austrians wanted to take back territory from the Serbs, and so you've kind of got this belief that we can, that one could use warfare to, in an aggressive sense, to kind of, in a short, sharp way, take back a strategic objective. And what we found instead was that wasn't the case at all, that really what you did was you rushed headlong into a maelstrom of bullets and artillery shells, and that usually there was some kind of degree of stalemate. Now, the classic sense is always the Western Front. But there were similar operational stalemates in places like Gallipoli, that would suggest that it was very difficult for powers in that era to go out and strike out offensively and take a strategic objective. But we're seeing repeated today, and I think this kind of falls on the heel of some of the really resounding conventional successes of the U.S. military, is that you can use modern techniques of warfare, whether that be precision-guided munitions or cyber weapons or what have you, to conduct offensive operations that allow you to seize and hold strategic objectives in a way that is relatively rapid and relatively painless. And, you know, about a year ago, maybe 6 months ago, the Chinese were conducting war games and exercises off their eastern coast. And these were really exercises in which they conducted kind of a putative war against Japan that was, you know, to quote the naval assessment of it, it was short and sharp. And really what it essentially said was the Chinese military was practicing for a war in which they would seize a handful of islands from Japan in a very short, rapid, quick, relatively costless war. And I see in there kind of a parallel in that there's this belief that you can take and seize and hold strategic objectives using the implements of modern warfare with relatively small consequences and without the possibility of a very long and protracted conflict. And to me, that's really the parallel that I was thinking of.
Eagle One?
Oh, can't find that on-off switch again. How much of the parallel you're looking at pertains to a situation where China probably doesn't have a lot of interest in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but really wants that inner island chain and Taiwan? You know, is that a different situation, or is that more akin to what we had in World War One?
I think that there's, you know, the particulars of the specific geographical questions are probably a little bit different. I mean, obviously, there, you know, in one case, there's a very clear, land border shared by two countries, and they're fighting over it in the case of Alsace-Lorraine and France and Germany. But in this case, there's still the remnants of irredentism. There's still this belief that this territory is ours, or at least by rights should be ours, and we would like to retake it, and we think we can. We think that the military balance or the way that military technology has developed and the strategy that the strategic oeuvre of the era, I'm searching for the word, but you know what I'm saying, the paradigm of the current era is favorable to this kind of short and sharp war to retake these pieces of territory. And I think that's a really pernicious mistake to make on any side, but in particular in this case, in which you've got the two largest economies in the world potentially lining up against each other to fight with weapons that we've never really used against another capable, competent adversary of that size. And I think the possibility that the war could go very, very badly and go very long and be very destructive is one that we probably haven't thought about enough.
That a perfect lead in to one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because it's that thinking beyond your assumptions. The branch plans that are never written because they're too difficult, too hard, and too uncomfortable to want to brief to people up the chain. And I'll stick with more recent history here, because you touch on something that a lot of people are very uncomfortable talking about. A lot of it because it's difficult to talk about in an unclassified environment, but I think we're safe to. You brought up what I like to call the quandary of the bunker, the war reserves, because we can look back to the state of the Royal Navy during the Falkland Islands conflict and their ASW weapons utilization. But you can also look even more recently. I think the Danes were in the worst shape after the very short duration Libyan campaign, that you can quickly run out of your precision-guided munitions. I also think, you know, one of my favorite areas to what if is another assumption that we have is unencumbered access to the electromagnetic spectrum, whether that's satellite communications, IP-based paths. We make a lot of assumptions there. And the follow-on question that I always find the most curious is, in the event you have a conflict that goes long and you run out of your precision-guided munitions, you know, the one advantage they had in the First World War is, yeah, they were running out of artillery shells, but you can ramp up production in that, not overnight, but a lot quicker than it is to produce a Mark 54 torpedo or any of your airdrop precision-guided munitions that you want to use, or for that matter, relearn how to use HF data links because you can't access your satellite anymore. Do you have a feeling that we are intentionally avoiding wargaming and discussing that in detail? Or is there a good enough red cell in the Western military that's asking the what if and the how should you reach that point, but you still have to fight?
So at the risk of sounding very, you know, self-congratulatory and you know, pumping up CFBA a little bit, I do think that our organization and also the Office of Net Assessment inside the Pentagon have been pretty good at thinking about these kind of, you know, thinking the unthinkable. What happens if this war were really to occur? What would it look like? How would it go? What would happen if it goes badly? What would happen if it becomes a protracted conflict even? So I think you're right in that most people aren't thinking about it, but in fairness, I would say over the last, you know, obviously better part of almost a decade and a half now, most of the U.S. military has been pretty head down occupied with fighting two large wars. And so I think it's fairly understandable that that hasn't been on the front burner. And then I think before that, we had this period from the end of the Cold War until 9/11, which there was kind of a question about what the future of military strategy would be when there's no real large peer competitor. And there were people at the beginning starting to think about, well, you know, if China starts to emerge as a real peer competitor, what could that mean? But for a long time, I think we've taken our own superiority, and not just superiority, but kind of vast military superiority over our opponents for granted for a large part. And I think that's led to this, what you're talking about, which is, you know, not thinking about the number of PGMs that we have in our arsenal and not thinking about what would it mean for our force structure if we start taking heavy attrition in certain major platforms, whether they be destroyers or submarines or aircraft carriers or long-range strike bombers. What would that mean for us when we only have a very, very limited number of them? And I, you know, one example I wanted to put in the paper, but I left out just for the sake of brevity, was the B-2 that caught in fire out at Anderson Air Force Base. You know, we have such a small number of B-2s, and they're such a major strategic asset that when one of them caught on fire, we had no choice but to spend a very, very large sum of money to resurrect that aircraft. And I don't question that decision. It was probably the right one. But it's indicative of how sensitive our force structure is to even a very small amount of attrition, and such that, you know, we would spend hundreds of millions of dollars to resurrect a bomber because we have to. We don't have a choice. So you start to look at a conflict where you might lose 5, 10, 15 bombers within weeks or months, and you start to think, well, how do you conduct that war over time? How does that go if that's the kind of attrition that you're seeing? And you're very right. You go back to World War One, and they could flip the switch and start producing artillery shells and artillery weapons. But if you go back, it's really interesting. The British and French, more so than the Germans, because the Germans had a little bit more artillery and more shells, but the British and French were taking guns off of their surface vessels and then mounting them to carriages and putting them into the line so that they could have an adequate number of artillery tubes. And actually a large number of the French artillery shells in late 1914 and early 1915 were going bad. They were blowing up their tubes because they hadn't been manufactured to the right specifications because they were trying to rush production. And, you know, every time we talk to, you know, the companies that manufacture precision-guided munitions, and particularly the more complex things like standoff cruise missiles, you know, we talk to them and they say, look, we couldn't ramp up this production if you asked us to. If you held a gun to our head tomorrow and said, you know, we need to up the production of this kind of precision-guided munition, they would say, okay, that's great. Give me 6 months to a year to build out a new factory, to hire the workers, to ramp up the production line, and then maybe I could turn you out two or three more per week than I'm doing right now. And so I don't think we've really, as a country and as a military, have thought through what does a protracted war look like when you're expending PGMs at a high rate. And like you mentioned, we've either not necessarily run out, but we've run low on PGMs. I mean, you mentioned the Danish case in Libya. But we ran low on PGMs in Kosovo. We ran low on them again in 2001 and 2 in Operation Enduring Freedom. We ran low on them again in 2003. I mean, it's a perennial thing where we underinvest in this capability that for any kind of serious war against, you know, not even a China type of conflict, but Iran, you know, or even something smaller, you're going to run out of them pretty quickly. And so I think we really need to start thinking about, you know, how do you, are we willing to reduce the efficiency of our defense production in order to have more of these on hand? Are we willing to invest in just stockpiling these and holding on to them in the event that something does go bad? I think that's really, we're not so good at thinking about what happens when things really, really go bad. I think we oftentimes find ourselves a little bit put out by that.
Yeah, I'm gonna go back into ancient history during the 1972 Easter invasion of South Vietnam by North Vietnam, and the ships on the gun line, 5-inch guns and 8-inch guns, were running low on ammo. I mean, we had a number of ammunition ships out there, and we had a stockpile in a nearby base, but eventually we were so low on ammo, we were flying 5-inch rounds in on C5s and putting them on the ammo ships to get out to the line. So, you know, there's a dumb weapon that we had trouble producing enough of when things went differently during the war than they thought they would. And I guess I was kind of pleased to see that you addressed a little bit in your piece the logistics supply ships for the Navy, and I'm wondering what prompted you to look at that. I mean, other than just PGMs, but there's a whole lot of other equipment and stuff we would need to add to fight a war.
So one of my colleagues, Dr. John Stillian at CSBA. We've done a lot of war games, and you know, one of the CFP's big things is war gaming, and we, you know, examine all these kind of, you know, future war game type issues, and you get a lot of hand waving where players don't really want to address logistics. They want to say, well, I'm gonna craft this really perfect operational concept, and it's gonna do everything, and it's gonna solve all my problems. And so Dr. Stillian said, well, you know, I'd actually like to put some logistics constraints on this. And so we looked at it, and you know, you find that these brilliant plans where, you know, every carrier strike group is you know, steaming ahead, and you've got all the aircraft launching from all the bases, you find that very quickly logistics puts a major crimp into all those sorts of plans and operational concepts, and it does so repeatedly, and it's a very hard physical constraint. You know, the tanker can only take you so far. We only have so many tankers, and you can only fit so many tankers at this base or that base, and it's a really hard constraint that you just can't get around. And, you know, when I saw that and when I saw the degree to which it crippled our ability to conduct operations, it was really kind of a light bulb went off for me. And I think it's also coupled with the fact that, you know, as unsexy as logistics are, they're remarkably cost-effective. So we oftentimes think about, you know, we're going to invest more in destroyers, we're going to invest more in carriers, and you know, I mean, the defense, you know, when there was a discussion during sequestration of cutting one of the carriers, I mean, this kind of endless back and forth about how many carriers do you have to have, and you know, what's the exact number of carriers. And you know, I also thought to myself, you know, wouldn't it be more instructive to discuss how many combat logistics force ships we have? Because it doesn't matter how many carriers we have out there if we can't support them. And if in a conflict an adversary were to sink even a handful of combat logistics force ships, we'd have a very difficult time supporting one or two carrier strike groups out at sea, let alone, you know, 10 or 11, or you know, to really, people were obsessing in my mind over the wrong metric. But again, they're unsexy. You know, nobody thinks, well, except for maybe me and a handful of other naval geeks, nobody thinks that TAKE is a sexy ship. And so people don't really talk about it all that much. But I think they're a remarkably important ship, and it's the kind of thing that we need to talk about if you're going to talk about protracted warfare. And I think, you know, one of the issues with protracted warfare that this gets at is that a lot of the issues are just not things people want to talk about on a day-to-day basis, even in war games where people are trying to think the unthinkable. And one of the things I'd, you know, of that ilk is what happens when you see major attrition, and not just to people. I mean, I don't want to mean to downplay that at all, but what happens when you start to see major attrition to a force structure that is increasingly built up of very capable, very exquisite, but very few in number types of aircraft, ships, and submarines? It's not something people want to think about. We like to see the 30-year shipbuilding plan, and we say, okay, that's how many DDG-51s we're going to have. We like to look at the aircraft plan, and we say, okay, we're going to have 180-odd F-22s forever and ever. We don't really like to think about, well, what if we fought a war where half of those aircraft were to go away within the first 2 weeks? You know, what if we fought a war in which, you know, we've got this build plan for submarines, but what if we go out and we lose, let's say, 10, 15 SSNs within the first 3 or 4 months of a conflict? What would that do to us strategically? And it takes a lot of courage to think about those problems, because the answers they're going to create are oftentimes going to be very difficult, but I think they're absolutely necessary.
Well, if you're talking about unsexy but important, you're with the right crowd. I think, Eagle One, I think that's been one of our regular topics here over the last 4.5 years or so. But, yeah, we try to bring attention to it as much as we can, because, yeah, one of my favorite topics that nobody wants to talk about, organic tanking capability with our carriers and how important that is, so you can just get some strategic depth if you need to project power ashore, as opposed to getting up close and personal. It's something that nobody really wants to talk about. And another thing, while we're talking about Westpac for a little bit here, I wanted to pick your mind a bit, because when you look at the beginning of the First World War, before the First World War, the British and the French general staff had this great plan about how they were working together. And, you know, the French played Charlie Brown a little bit to the British Lucy. They had all these promises that they expected the British to bring over. It didn't quite work out, and there was a lot of friction early on in the war where the French just didn't think the British were giving them what they needed. There was over expectations for the Allies, for Italian performance, given the size of their forces, and, of course, the Central Powers. They overestimated what the Ottomans would bring to the fight. But when you look at our major allies in the Westpac that we traditionally thought about, the Koreans, the Japanese, the Australians, are there some things that's going on in those countries, some trends in the national security area, that lead you to think that maybe we need to look a little closer at some of our assumptions? And do you see some of those changes in a positive direction, a negative direction, or a little mixture of the two?
I think for the most part it's positive, but I think you're right in looking back at history and saying it's always a tough thing to put a lot of pressure on your allies. It's always kind of an easy strategic out to say, well, you know, we're gonna export this problem to our allies, or we're gonna lean on them. But for the most part, I do see a lot of positive developments. You know, particularly with the Japanese and the Australians, but also with some partners in the region, whether they be, you know, the Philippines. You know, I feel like there's generally a move in the right direction. I think there's generally a concern over the creeping, slow, you know, this kind of simultaneous, very rapid military buildup, and then this kind of creeping, slow military, diplomatic, economic aggression displayed by China. Things like moving the oil rig off the coast of Vietnam, and, you know, occasionally occupying whatever little smidgen of the Scarborough Shoals are above sea level. So I do think that there's a lot of positive movement. The question is, one is, will that translate into actual military capability and cooperation, and two, will it be sustained over time? And I think those are questions I don't think anybody really knows, but I do think, generally speaking, there's been a lot of positive development. I know that recent white papers from both Japan and their Ministry of Defense, or their sort of Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and also the Australians, have both kind of highlighted, okay, cooperation at the military strategic level with the United States is really crucial. But I think, again, the devil really is in the details. So, are we going to really practice? Are we going to exercise? Are we going to ensure interoperability? And are we going to ensure that both sides are providing complementary capabilities? And I think that's the kind of secret sauce here, in terms of building a kind of holistic and stable military presence in Westpac. And I think that's something that's still being ironed out over time.
One of the things I was looking at when I was reading your paper was that a lot of technology, we're going to rely on many technological improvements in our system. So we're talking about like rail guns for the Navy and additional unmanned systems. Of course, that may require us to have that electromagnetic monopoly that Sal was talking about. But is there a way around this? Can we technology, if you will, our way out of this concern over not being ready, or is this we've got to have some stuff and just got to have it?
Ooh, that's a good question. And I think, unfortunately, I'm going to give you one of those kind of weaselly yes and no answers. I think no. There is ultimately no single technological magic bullet to any military strategic problem. And I think somebody who would suggest that there is probably lying to you or selling something. But I do think that there are technologies and technological trends that could, there may not necessarily be favorable or negative to the United States, but it depends on, how each side seizes on them and operationalizes them. And, I think you touched on it, unmanned, robotic, or, whatever you want to call it, is over the last, I'd say, maybe 10 years, has been a kind of an asymmetric advantage for the United States in irregular conflicts. And we're just really starting to exploit it for more conventional purposes. But the problem with it is that as great as the technology is, it also lowers some barriers to entry for other countries. So, suddenly if I'm a country X and I want to develop an Air Force, I don't need to develop a cadre of trained pilots, which really, at the end of the day, is the hardest thing to do. It's one thing to go out and buy aircraft and build an airfield. It's a whole other thing to develop pilots. When you see air forces crumble, whether it be Nazi Germany and the Luftwaffe or the Imperial Japanese Air Force, and both in World War II, what really crippled those air forces was when they started to lose their skilled pilots. They were still making aircraft and quite capable aircraft well deep into the war. But once the Japanese made this strategic choice to start going to kamikaze attacks and they lost all of their skilled pilots, then you get into this kind of death spiral where you're training newer pilots and you're training them faster, you're sending them up, and then they start dying even quicker, and then you increase the speed of the training, and it just kind of goes on like that until you just don't have an Air Force anymore. So you can get out of that paradigm with unmanned. And unfortunately, the United States right now, our big advantage over almost every other adversary, we have a technological one, but we have a phenomenal ability to crank out very highly skilled, very capable pilots and train them at a very high level. What if that is no longer a key metric in an air power competition? Well, that suddenly sounds like a really bad thing for the United States. The good thing is, and I think, if I'm permitting you a little bit of, blatant patriotism here, I think one good thing about the United States is we've shown an ability over time to embrace disruptive change, whether it's societal, economic, or technological. We're very good and very comfortable with the idea that change is going to come and it's inevitable, and so how do we deal with it and incorporate it in a way that I think some other countries may not be as comfortable with. And I think we can use that in a military strategic way if we're willing to do so. But I think it remains to be seen whether or not we're going to see us fight a rearguard action against the implementation of kind of robotic systems, or if we're going to embrace them. And it's really a mixed bag inside all the services and as well as in DOD as to, where are we going to embrace robotics? How are we going to do it? What sorts of things can we, where is it appropriate? Where is it not? And these questions are still getting answered. And then I think there's another piece that I actually really enjoy talking about. It's something I get really excited about whenever I see it briefed or wherever I see it talked about, and that's additive manufacturing or 3D printing. And this is kind of one of these technologies that's always on the cusp, but it's kind of always out there and it's coming, but it's never really quite arrived. And over the last 5-6 years and over the next maybe 5 to 10 years, I think it really is going to arrive. And the question is, how do we incorporate it and how do we build it into our program such that we can exploit it to the maximum advantage? But it's this ability to do flexible, tailorable manufacturing of certain parts or even maybe potentially the future entire systems that would allow us to have this kind of rapid, flexible defense production capacity that we currently don't have. So, you know, when I was talking earlier about, like, well, how will we build a PGM if suddenly we shoot all of our PGMs or 90% of them in the opening salvos of a war, and then we're falling back on a non-existent stockpile? Additive manufacturing may not be a panacea, but it may be one way to offset that by having a flexible production capacity that could turn on and, say, churn out large numbers of PGMs or PGM subcomponents, if you will, at least in the near term, in a way that doesn't require you to build an enormous defense infrastructure that's dedicated to producing one particular thing. I don't know if you want me to go down that rabbit hole. I'm happy to discuss additive manufacturing a little bit more because I find it so interesting in terms of what it could do for defense strategy.
Yeah, let's run down that little rabbit hole, and let me spin it in a certain direction for you, because I've been thinking a lot about that myself recently. And you talk about, it's a little overused, if our friend Matt Hipple's listening, yes, I'm talking to you. There's a little overuse of, you know, disruptive technology, and it's a fun buzzword. I like it because it gets people to talk. But one area that it really potentially influences a whole broad spectrum of military thought is the capability and the challenge of really having a dispersed and redundant system of manufacturing where a lot of our targeteers and our strike and our strategic bombing people like to look at manufacturing nodes and economic modes, you know, the old Schweinfurt, if we take out the ball bearings and everything else falls apart theory. But if you have this ability with the new manufacturing technology that you can forward deploy the ability to produce, you know, X number of pieces of machinery that used to require Y number of manufacturing facilities located in a few small areas, it really does change the ability for nations to perhaps address some of the issues we've talked about here about limited weapons and peace to be able to flex to war. But where do you see some of those really disruptive areas coming into play that is going to cause at least perhaps some of our sexy but important areas to really be able to restructure and change the way traditionally we have addressed it?
So, I mean, I think, you hit on it with the additive manufacturing piece. It's partly the ability to flexibly manufacture a large number of things and therefore possibly change the production paradigm for how we build major defense systems. You could see a future in which large systems integrators are really integrating subsystems all churned out from a large number of 3D manufacturing facilities that, could possibly be government-owned, as in the case of the old, the old arsenals, in which, the government owned, a big place where they would churn out machined, tools or rifles, and then people would submit designs and say, okay, we're going to build that. Or you might just see, a split between manufacturing and design. There's any number of the ways that could happen. Another thing also, as you mentioned, is it could upend very kind of, and then this is one thing we're getting back to the logistics piece, our logistics system has become very fragile and very just in time. And it makes sense. It hasn't faced any concerted opposition. So in kind of a vacuum, the logistics system has optimized for efficiency, which makes absolute perfect sense. Cost matters. Wars cost money, and so you need to make your logistics as efficient as possible. And whenever we're looking to cut the military, the first thing we look to cut is the tails. increase our truth-to-tail ratio without really thinking about what that means for actual combat capability. And what additive manufacturing could do is maybe allow you to lean it out a little bit while also maintaining a robustness and ability to withstand attrition and withstand damage. And what I'm thinking about here is, you know, the kind of very small and esoteric spare parts that you need to maintain a given aircraft or ship. If you didn't have to ship that out from CONUS, or you didn't have to maintain a stockpile of it forward, now suddenly your lines of communication are less crucial, at least in that particular instance. Now there's always going to be the need to have fuel and munitions shipped out. I don't think we're ever going to have a forward manufacturing capacity for those types of things. But, I mean, you know, I'm trying to imagine a situation where 20 years from now, you know, a destroyer is on a deployment and a spare part breaks, they would have a small 3D manufacturing capability on board that would allow them to remanufacture that part and not have to take the time to steam all the way back to, you know, whatever the nearest forward operating base is to get a repair and then go back into the fight. And when you've got as limited of a force structure as we do, that kind of capability, you know, it doesn't seem game-changing, but all of a sudden you're maintaining time on station for a ship by, you know, as much as maybe 3 weeks that you wouldn't have had otherwise. And, doesn't seem huge, but it actually can be in terms of combat capability. And I think that's one thing, you know, when we obsess over the numbers of combat aircraft and the numbers of ships and we lose sight of how important the enablers are and how important the logistics is. And, you know, you were talking about the kind of unchallenged electromagnetic spectrum. And I want to come back to that because that's actually a really cool way to tie it back to World War One. If you look at the combat interactions on the Western Front in World War One, there was actually, you know, as tactically dominant as firepower was in that era, you still saw fairly regular breakthroughs of the defensive lines. So, you know, as defensively dominant as the regime was, both sides on many occasions would break through the enemy's lines, and they would get through the first kind of sets of opening pickets and opening defenses and trench lines, but then their momentum would almost inevitably stop. And the reason was, for large part, is because they couldn't bring their command and control and their logistics with them. So very rapidly, they would lose momentum because there was nobody telling them where to go or what to do or coordinating their activities. And you couldn't bring the guns up with them. You couldn't get the machine guns across. And you couldn't get the shells and munitions and all the other things you need to go with that across the kind of, you know, the muddy, bloody craters of no man's land. And so everything would inevitably peter out to make counterattacks, and they would squeeze off the salient, and that would be the end of it. And I think if you look at that today, you know, what does it mean if the EM spectrum is incredibly contested, or, you know, the SLOCs are contested? Can you sustain aggressive offensive operations without repeated hits from a tanker or from some ship bringing in munitions, or, you know, just kind of any kind of logistics capability? What happens to the pace and the tempo of your operations when that lifeline is cut off? Can you sustain rapid operations? I think the answer we're going to find is that no, you can't. The example, even if it's not, you know, even if it's not this kind of esoteric 21st century, you know, very highly attuned and efficient logistics system that we have today, you know, the example of Eagle One gave, like, you know, we couldn't get dumb shells to naval vessels in Vietnam in 1972. So, and I mean, look at the weight of effort we were applying toward that and how little our SLOCs were. I mean, there weren't Vietnamese submarines intercepting shipments between Pearl and Vietnam. It just wasn't happening. So that was kind of uncontested. So if logistics is tough uncontested, what happens when, you know, Japan or potentially Iran or maybe Russia is out there with SSNs attacking your logistics fleets as they're coming in, or, you know, sending missiles to attack the ports or airfields that you're going to land at? Suddenly that problem that's difficult enough in peacetime or in kind of a low-level conflict becomes just exponentially more difficult.
Well, speaking of exponentially more difficult, the situation in Iraq right now and Syria, and we're looking, you know, this no boots on the ground thing, it took us forever to gear up to go into Iraq for the first Gulf War. Is there a situation now where we have to have a bifurcated force, where we got the high-tech whiz bang stuff, and then the dumb, if you will, and not any reference to their intellectual ability, but the foot soldier. I mean, is that a whole separate animal, or is that also need to be addressed? As how do we get our boots on the ground when we need them there in a hurry and sustain them while they're in the field?
Well, and that's a great question, especially if you believe, like, you know, I do and many of my colleagues at CSDA, that the low end of warfare is going to get more difficult over time. So, you know, if people like, I mean, you look at what ISIS has, I mean, and they've mostly got, you know, a handful of armored weapons or vehicles that they've captured, but mostly they're in kind of technicals, you know, pickup trucks with 50 TALs and whatnot. So they don't have a terribly sophisticated weapon capability, similar to what we saw by like Hezbollah in 2006, but it's still more sophisticated than a lot of insurgent groups. What happens when, you know, you've got an ISIS that's armed with anti-tank anti-tank munitions, you know, high altitude, you know, new generation man pads with multimodal seekers? I mean, that could be a potentially much more difficult problem. But getting into the kind of crux of your question, I do think, and this is, you know, my personal, you know, like pet theory, is that one of the problems the United States faces is that every major military empire, you know, whether it's the Brits, the Romans, what have you, is there's a tension between seeing off potential kind of imperial challengers and peer competitors, and kind of day-to-day, week-by-week, month-by-month maintenance of the empire. And, you know, in this case, you know, I'm using empire in kind of a very broad sense. But you're right in that, you know, you've got to have the foot soldiers, and you've got to have this high tech capability. And how do you balance out that, that cost requirement? Because, you know, foot soldiers in the individual are cheap, but to get them in numbers in which they're significant, they're not cheap. And the high tech stuff is likewise costly. But what I do think, and I think this is a consensus, at least at CSDA, and it's one that I agree with, is that what you need to go toward is a bit of a high-low mix, and I think right now our force structure is very much in the middle. So we face this multiplicity of problems, and we build systems that are kind of at the median of all those problems. Instead, we need to go, instead of driving ourselves toward the meaty part of the bell curve, I think we need to get out towards the tails a little bit more. And so, a good example of that is the UCLASS program. I think, you know, I'm not really sure that we need yet another ability to reach out and touch terrorists with unmanned systems. I think we need a long-range penetrating standoff strike capability. But, you know, that's, you know, in a particular programmatic sense, that's one area in which I think you see it. Is that, you know, what do you need for that particular thing? But at the same time, that doesn't mean you abandon the low-level UAS that does counterterrorism capabilities, because you need that as well. So how do you get yourself out of this middle where you've got capabilities that are really expensive and a little bit too exquisite to go hunting terrorists and that aren't, you know, providing that stability, but at the same time aren't yet capable enough to see off the peer competitor?
I think you outlined that, you know, a lot of the trouble that we have here isn't so much technological. It's a failure of critical thinking and intellect. It's a human problem. It's a thinking problem, and the weighing between the different layers of requirements and politics and personalities. And, you know, part of your background, you know, your textbook example of somebody you would want at CSBA, you have a BA in Security Studies from University of Washington. You went on to get a Master's in Strategic Studies from Johns Hopkins. You actually have a military background from 97 to 2000. You're with the 75th Ranger Regiment. And a lot of people that populate the think tanks and influence nodes, they come from a variety of different confessions in the policy wonkdom area, whether it's political science, national security studies, history, a few career military types that recycle back in, like Bob Work, who's now the Undersecretary of Defense. But in many ways, when you look at one of the discussions that's been top of mind the last couple weeks, in spite of the fact, you know, forget about, quote, ancient history to Vietnam and older there, Eagle One, we'll snag at you. Let's just look inside of our own little common reference there. We went into Afghanistan thinking that air power, soft, light was going to work. We went into Iraq with Donald Rumsfeld's concept of smaller, smarter, faster, better. But in both cases, it was in the six figures, boot on the ground, holding a rifle and the other boot going through somebody's door to be able to change the facts on the ground. And I wonder if perhaps we need a little more of a influence in psychology, psychiatry. You know, what is the intellect? What is the source of the intellectual problem we have of wanting to repeat like we are right now in Syria and Iraq, thinking that with air power and a few people we can create big differences on the ground? Is this a failure from the professional military intellectual side of the house, or is this more of a challenge of the civilian and political masters either not having the right advisors or just not having the depth of experience, intellectual curiosity enough to be able to accept that sometimes things are a little more difficult than the best case COA?
I think it may be even a little deeper than that, and I think it's reflective of kind of a broader American societal issue, and I think that's that we're perpetual optimists. We're a country of people who believe in the future being better than the past and, kind of endless progress. And, the next generation is going to be wealthier than the last one and so on and so forth. And I think that kind of leads itself to this belief that, oh, yeah, it's this can-do attitude. We can do that. Of course we can. And, the military, in so much as it has that can-do attitude, which I think is, one of the great strengths of our military, reflects that. It reflects this belief that, yes, well, of course we can do that. I don't care how hard the task that you give me, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do it. It doesn't matter if it badly injures me or it kills half my force. I'm going to go do it. But I think one of the things when you talked to me about this question before that I thought about was I was a ranger. We used to go out for these runs, and I was a private, so you're just always running these runs where your squad leader or whomever your platoon sergeant takes you out for 5-10 mile run, and you're just it's Monday morning and you're tired and you're going to do like 5 30-minute miles forever until you fall over. And inevitably we would come back into our battalion, and sometimes you'd be in formation or what have you. And you'd go from double time running down to, marching time, and you'd move like you were going to go back toward your bunks or toward the chow hall. And then all of a sudden you hear the double time command again. And then you take off through the other side of the battalion. You just march straight through it. You'd never stop. And then you go out running for another 2 or 3 miles. And, the purpose of that was to teach you that even when you think it's going well, it's inevitably going to go bad. Things are going to get bad, and when they're going to be bad, they're only going to be worse. And I think that's the kind of mentality that it's kind of antithetical to a lot of, what we're taught as Americans, but I think it's important to have in your mind and in your kind of intellectual rucksack, if you will, is this, what does this look like when this really goes bad? How could this get even worse? And if that were to happen, am I prepared for that? Am I prepared for the worst possible outcome here? And, you don't always want to plan for that because it can be prohibitively expensive. But at least having it in mind and thinking about it is a worthwhile exercise. And I really think that one of the problems we have is that we don't often plan for that. And I think, and maybe I'm saying this with hindsight because I'm a little bit too young to remember, because I'm still kind of a kid toward the tail end of the Cold War, but I talk to my colleagues who are a little bit older than me, and they talk about their more realistic planning that they did during the Cold War. And there was a lot of understanding. Yes, if there is a war with the Soviet Union, large number of us are going to die. Huge numbers of aircraft are going to get shot down, bases are going to be blown up, ships are going to be sunk, lives are going to be lost. But, if we do this well and we plan for it, and maybe we can deter that or stop it, if we have to fight this war, maybe we can come out on top. And I think that people of my generation who've grown up with sort of unquestioned American superiority, and, for me, I think the formative, instance was the first Gulf War. That was, I think, probably about 12 or 13 when it occurred, and I remember watching it on TV. And beforehand, you're thinking, well, the Iraqis at the time had the fourth largest military in the world, and they've got all these, they had some decent post, late Soviet capabilities, and they're talking about the mother of all battles, and then pretty soon we just smashed over them. And then you think, you know, after that, it's this kind of paradigm shift of like, well, you don't really need to worry about the worst case scenario because it's not really going to happen. And I think we're getting back toward normal reality again. You know, there's peer competitors. There's countries that could actually fight against us again, with, you know, who are capable, competent adversaries with an economy of a similar size to ours. You know, that's a different kind of world than we've been in for the last 30 years. And I think it's good to start thinking about that.
Yeah, it's interesting you both seem to think we've gotten away from the worst case scenario, because when I was a junior officer, I was certainly brought up that way. I mean, you did that way from being on watch, what would happen if cases to later on when you do your commander's estimate of the situation. You know, you always assess what's the worst thing that could happen. And a lot of things we did, even during the Gulf War, were based on, you know, suppose this happened, and we had things in place if they did. But it's interesting to me that you don't think we necessarily are doing that now.
I would say it's a matter of degrees and it's a matter of focus. I think there's probably a lot of tactical and even operational leaders who are probably thinking that way. But I think perhaps at the more strategic level, and I don't think this lays at any particular person's feet, I think it's more just a broader issue. I think it's hard for us to strategically conceptualize an era in which something really, really does go bad. People are admittedly quite concerned about developments in Iraq right now. But, you know, we're talking about ISIS as though it's a massive strategic threat to the United States. I mean, a strategic threat. And I personally think strategic threat, and I think Soviet Union in the 1970s, you know, this is a country with enough nuclear weapons to wipe us off the face of the planet. And they've got, you know, division after division after division of armored forces in Central Europe. That to me is a strategic threat. A bunch of guys running around in the desert with AK-47s in the back of Jeeps is really not, to me, a strategic threat. It's a very bad thing. It deserves some attention, but it's not a strategic threat. But in the post-Cold War world, that's kind of where we are. There's not an ability for us to really deeply think about what's a real bad strategic threat here. And I don't think that's, you know, it doesn't, you know, I don't know that it lays at anybody's feet. It's just a matter of the era in which we're in. It's very hard to think about that. And I think it's something that may require a kind of Pearl Harbor-esque, you know, instance for us to kind of go, oh my gosh, you know, we might actually really have to think about this. And I don't know that it's, you know, it's going to happen without that kind of external stimulus.
While you were talking, I looked over at my outstanding studio here is a corner of my library, and I was looking at my complete collection of Peter Hopkirk's work, and the Great Game is the biggest of his works that he put out there, and it had me thinking of Russia, because Russia always seems to surprise the international community either by its strengths or its weakness at any one time, and few actually seem to get Russia right. And you mentioned in your article about a resurgent Russia, one of the challenges that we need to be looking at. And from a historical perspective, the Russia that we're seeing right now, what they're doing in Ukraine, if we're talking to a group of Russia specialists and we're asking them, you know, what type of time period do you think is a good reference point for what we're looking at in Russia right now? Or is this something that is really kind of unique from what we've seen in the Russian mentality and how they work with their near abroad?
Oh, boy. I wouldn't even try to play a Russia expert on TV, but I'll tread lightly with this. But I do think that, I think what you're seeing is part of a broader historical pattern with Russia, and that is that, you know, when they sense an ability to shift the order in their near rod to their advantage, I think they'll do it. And I think one of the things we learned, you know, after the Cold War and kind of the archives opened up, again, and this was hard for us as Americans to understand, is that we didn't have the same type of neuralgia surrounding, this particular area that they did. But, you know, once somebody put missiles in Cuba, we freaked out. And that was kind of our point of neuralgia. And it's just, you know, it'd be hard to understand what it might feel like to be in a country where you feel like you're surrounded by potential Cubas, in which, you know, whether or not they're actually going to be subverted and go against you and, you know, invite foreign forces in, even if that's not the reality, you may feel that way. And so I think that's, you know, as long as that's the situation and then they feel like they're threatened on all their sides, this is probably, a, at least for them, from their perspective, kind of a rational way of dealing with this problem, even though to us it may seem like a kind of a crazed, backward 19th century violation of international norms. You know, for them, from their perspective, this is kind of business as usual. Now, I'm by no means a Russia expert, but that's at least my reading of it. And especially, I love that Peter Hopkirk book. The Great Game is probably one of my favorite books of kind of military strategic history.
Well, we're running out of time. In fact, we've run out of time, but I'm going to ask another question because we didn't really get into
absolutely.
It. But to the extent that our alliances are important to what happened in World War One, are we facing similar situations now, or are alliances now much weaker than they were in 1914?
You know, I think our alliances are every bit as strong. I just think that there's probably not quite the very tight zero-sum game, tail wagging the dog system that you had in place prior to World War One. I think our alliances and our commitments are every bit as strong as they've ever been. But I don't think you've got this kind of, and frankly, I mean, a lot of that, you know, you go back and read about World War One, a lot of that's just kind of driven by the overweening pride of the Kaiser, you know, this kind of belief that I'm going to write a blank check and I'm going to reorder Europe the way I see fit. You know, it's a lot of that is very much that kind of, you know, here's the blank check, Austria, go ahead, you know, and it draws you into that, which I don't think we have today. There's nobody out there who's kind of that crazy right now. Although, you know, you never want to presume, you know, you never want to say, well, that's never going to happen. Cause you know, as strategists, we all have to plan for the worst. And so, you know, it might behoove everybody on all sides to start planning around what would happen if, you know, if we lost the kind of rational actors in the region and were replaced with people who didn't think that way anymore. But I don't see the same kind of fraught with peril environment that we faced at that time.
The eternal pursuit of rational actors. I mean, you could do a great article just on the rational actors that everybody thought were rational that turned irrational. But Chris, we've already chewed up an hour. It's been a great hour. I really appreciate you taking time to join us. What are you working on right now, and where could we look to read what you've been investing your noggin in?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm actually leaving the Center for Strategic Budgetary Assessments. I'm going into the Office of the Secretary of Defense as an IPA in the Strategy Office. I'm going to be doing analysis. It's something I've been working on for a long time, and it's finally come through. I'm very excited about it. But at CSDA, over the last few, I've been working a lot on unmanned systems. So a lot of the discussion about additive manufacturing and robotics comes from that. That's, you know, just been a particular interest of mine over the last few months before I take off. But another big thing that I've been looking at is the future of the ground forces. You know, I'm one of the few ground guys at CSDA, and I like to fight the rearguard action and defense the Army. But, you know, in the context of this piece, I was thinking, you know, the Army, from a strategic perspective, is really just, they're having some problems right now, and I think they're kind of a convenient strategic punching bag to say, you know, oh, the Army's out of touch with the current operational and strategic environment and this, that, and the other. But I would say that one thing the Army does tend to do well, and it tends to do it better than the other services, is think long and hard about protracted warfare. You know, the Army is not set up to do quick hit, in and out expeditionary warfare in the sense that the Marines are. When the Army comes in, they're looking to take and seize and hold territory for quite some time. And that leads to a mindset of, okay, how are we going to support this logistically? How are we going to do this? And not just over days or weeks, but months and years. And I think, you know, if the Army takes that and starts thinking about, okay, if the future might actually be a little bit more protracted, or we're not going to fight these kind of shorter wars and things are going to get uncomfortable and tough, how can the Army, you know, exploit its kind of perspective on protraction to its advantage? And I haven't seen them do that yet. Maybe they will. I'd love to see it because I think it's a perspective that we need. But that's one thing that I've actually really been thinking about is, you know, where does the Army go from here if we really do keep pursuing the pivot to the Pacific in an environment in which, you know, big major ground forces are slightly less relevant to the potential war fight?
Well, that is gainful employment, and you're finding, it sounds like you have found a place to go to that definitely is going to be gainful employment. So congratulations, and look forward to maybe talking to you in the future.
Absolutely. I'd love to do it. I had a great time.
Yes. Thanks a lot, Chris. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And you're welcome, Chris, and thank you, everybody, for joining us. And we look forward to seeing you next time for another edition of MidRats. Until then, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.